Hello and welcome to Monday Morning, where we react to the Sunday morning news shows that we watch so that you don't have to. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Mary Matte. Good Monday morning, everybody. Thank you for being here with us. Please like the stream. And also, don't forget to go to usefulidiotspodcast.com where you can support the show and get bonus content. Last week's interview was with Chaz Freeman, the veteran U.S. diplomat. He had some great stuff to say.
Yeah, he said that the values of Israel are like the values of the KKK. How's that for clickbait / getting shut down on YouTube? One of the two things.
Absolutely. But,
yeah, that was really great. So shall we start?
Let's hit it.
Let's hit it. With, as always, we start with MTP, Meet the Press.
With Kristen Welker.
Good Sunday morning. Super Tuesday is just 48 hours away. Is this Nikki Haley's last stand? And could this be the beginning of the general election? 15 states cast their votes in Republican nominating contests on Tuesday, the biggest primary day of the election season, with 865 delegates at stake, more than a third of the
All right, so many buttons, guys. Not political content. I just wanted to give her a shout out for the buttons. A lot of them.
Maybe there's one button for every Super Tuesday state.
Yeah, that would be great, yeah.
Delegates in the Republican race. Now, Nikki Haley has lost 8 of the first 8 contests, struggling to match the 43% of the vote she won in New Hampshire. On Saturday, she lost caucuses in 3 more states. In Missouri, where former President Donald Trump won every county. Idaho, where Trump swept all 32 of the state's delegates. Trump also won the caucuses in Michigan after winning the primary there earlier this week.
If you look at the early states, he may have won them, yes, but he didn't get 40% of the vote. That's no small number.
We will win big on Super Tuesday, and this November, Virginia is going to tell crooked Joe Biden, you're fired, you're fired.
Haley is now dialing back expectations, telling me her goal on Tuesday is a, quote, competitive showing against Donald Trump, not necessarily to win states. Haley also weighing in on the Supreme Court's decision to.
Well, listen, we have the benefit of now being 24 hours later, so we can have some breaking political news from the Useful Idiots political desk. Nikki Haley has won a primary. She won in Washington, D.C., where she got a whopping 1,274 votes. So Nikki Haley has won a primary, everybody. So in your face. So yeah. It happens to be in the nation's capital, which doesn't really matter. And it happens to be a tiny number of people. And of course, where the people voting are like the military contractors who Nikki Haley mostly serves, because you know, she is one of them. She serves on the board right. of a weapons company, and she's a neocon, like a full-on neocon. So, but Nikki Haley has won a primary, everybody. So those who are counting her out aren't up to date on the latest, and that's where we're here.
Yeah, breaking news from the political desk. That's yeah. That's the symbol for that, Aaron. When I go okay. like that,
got it.
Means I'm getting a story. Yeah.
Your arguments over Mr. Trump's claim that he's immune from criminal prosecution for allegedly trying to overturn the 2020 election.
I think you need to have the Supreme Court settle this. I don't think that a president should be immune from anything. I think that the president has to live under laws, too.
Should Trump's classified document case go to trial, do you think, before November?
I think all of the cases should be dealt with before November. We need to know what's going to happen before it before the presidency happens, because after that, should he become president, I don't think any of it's going to get heard.
Now, Trump weighed in on his legal battles at a rally in Virginia last night.
It's really impossible for me to get a fair trial in D.C., but that's okay. Don't worry. I don't know what's going to happen. I really don't. But it's all going to work out. We're going to come out so good. I'm more popular than I ever was because of these people.
Trump leads Biden.
I mean, where's the lie there in terms of all this helping his popularity? Like, right. they've given him all these cases, and it's not hurting him at all in the polls. If anything, it's helping him.
Right. We've warned against that.
We did. We certainly did. God. Where haven't we been right on all this stuff? We called it. We did not buy into Doc Talk.
Right, we didn't. Yeah, we saw through the Doc Talk.
When Doc Talk was sweeping the nation, all this talk about classified documents, we were not on board.
Right.
Yes.
We warned. All right. Here's some exciting news. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
By 5 points, 48% to 43% in a new poll of registered voters from the New York Times and Siena College. And there is an enthusiasm gap. Just 23% of Democratic primary voters say they will feel enthusiastic if Biden is the Democratic nominee as expected. That's half of the number of Republicans enthusiastic about Trump. Joining us for more on what this week's results in Michigan say about a potential Trump-Biden rematch and for a reality check on Haley's path on Super Tuesday is NBC.
Again, Steve Kornacki, first of all, look at this weird camera shot they're giving him.
Yeah, very weird.
Yeah. What is he, like a Roman emperor addressing a Colosseum? This is just, it's very strange.
Yeah, it is.
And then again, they put the percentage symbol in his name with two O's. It's Kornacki, not Kornacki.
Oh, I never even saw it that way. Yeah, I think you're supposed to just see the percentage thing, but there is a risk that people now think his name is Kornacki.
Yeah, Kornacki.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been warning about this.
Another thing we've been right about.
One thing we're also against, Katie, which we've also warned about, is against the fetishization of Steve Kornacki.
Yeah.
You know, they have the Kornacki cam where, like, even when someone else is talking on MSNBC, they'll still have, like, a cam on him, like, you know, like just going away. It's, you know, he's exploited. He's like,
it is. It's
like OnlyFans.
Yeah. It's
on cable news.
Cornly fans. Cornly fans. Yeah.
Cornly fans. Yes.
Yeah. News political correspondent, Steve Kornacki. Steve, break it all down for us.
That actually be corny fans. That could be like a thing. Corny. Because, you know, the whole thing is pretty corny.
Right.
He is Kornacki. Corny fans. Bam. Fans. Let's brand it, everybody.
Brand it, yeah. Yeah. Put a little TM on that. Cornballs. His fans could be called cornballs.
Yeah, Kristen. Well, look, all eyes were on Michigan this week, obviously for the primary, but also because it will be a important, maybe the pivotal state in the general election if it is indeed a Trump-Biden rematch. Take a look here. We're giving you the states as they went in 2020 in the Trump-Biden election. If you re-ran them, remember, the states have different electoral count votes now. Some of them at least do. If you re-ran 2020, Biden would now start out with 303, Trump with 235. But how did Biden win in 2020? Remember, he flipped five.
By the way, I thought that said road to what W, like what TF,
like WTF.
Yeah.
States that Donald Trump had carried in 2016. That was Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Arizona. So if Trump has a path back to the White House, it probably goes through those five states. Now, take a look in terms of underscoring the importance of Michigan and those three Midwest states. If you start with Georgia and Arizona, they were the two closest in 2020. So let's say, just for the sake of showing you this, that Trump is somehow able to flip those states. If he were to get Georgia, if he were to get Arizona, he would still be short of 270, and that would bring you to those Midwest states. And he would need to flip one of them in this scenario to get over 270. You can see if he were to get Michigan here, then he'd be over 270. So any Trump path back to the,
you know, I'm just sharing some real life feedback here. I can't even follow what he's saying here. Corny fans is not for, I will not be buying a subscription to Corny fans. It's not for me. This content, my brain, it doesn't compute. I don't know what he's talking about.
I mean, he's talking about the Electoral College.
No, I get that. But like, you know, all these probabilities and this state going this way, you know, it just doesn't, it's not clicking.
You just saved yourself some money.
Exactly. Yes. One less subscription.
Yeah.
White House, he's going to have to win back at least one of those three Midwest states, and Michigan could actually end up being his best shot at it. You take a look at those primary results this week. As you mentioned, Trump here more than 40 points ahead of Nikki Haley. He does win every county in the state. You do see about a quarter of the vote there not going to Trump. Take that with a grain of salt. Remember, open primary in Michigan. Democrats could vote. Republicans could vote in the Republican primary. Some evidence that there's a fair number of Democrats and independents who've been coming into these primaries just because they want to vote against Donald Trump. But if you looked inside these counties, you would see what we've known for a while now. Donald Trump's biggest vulnerability, his softest support is in the suburbs, particularly suburbs with high concentrations of white voters with college degrees, affluent white voters. A place like Oakland County, just north of Michigan, gigantic white-collar suburban county. Joe Biden had carried this by almost 15 points in 2020. Trump did win it in this primary, but he did worse there than he did statewide.
I just want to highlight one comment from Eric. Bro needs a cooking show. I think that may be true.
Mm. Yeah. But, you know, what Steve Kornacki is laying out here, and again, this is not my forte, I'm not Mr. Electoral Politics, but this case he's making that Biden is doing well with the white suburban voters. That is the case that Chuck Schumer made back in 2016.
Right.
Remember when he was like, for every blue collar worker we lose, we'll pick up three.
That's good.
Moderate Republicans in the suburbs. So, you know, this is Carnacki maybe proving the Schumer doctrine.
Right. The Schumer doctrine.
Yes.
Schum doc.
Yeah.
So we're doing Schum doc talk.
Yeah. When Schumer retires, maybe he could be hired as like a Steve Carnacki sidekick. They could do it together. That'd be a great team.
But, you know, Aaron, before when you're like, I can't follow this. And I said the Electoral College. Of course, I know that you know the Electoral College, but the reason you can't follow probably is because the Electoral College makes no sense.
Mm. Yes, that's another thing.
It's so disgusting that this is how we vote.
Yeah.
The kind of county he may have some trouble in the fall. If Biden's going to win Michigan again, Biden's going to do it by driving up big numbers in places like.
All right, Carnacki, show us the uncommitted vote. That's what we care about.
Yeah.
But let's get to that. Come on. He's bearing the lead here.
He's bearing
Oakland
the lead.
Oakland County. Now, let's take a look at Joe Biden on the Democratic side. Again, he gets more than 80% of the vote in this week's primary and a lot of attention on the uncommitted vote, about 100,000 votes here. You see, there was an effort from activists.
Wait a second. Marianne Williamson beat Dean Phillips.
Yes, but didn't she also drop out?
She's unsuspended her campaign.
Oh, okay. All right.
But they should be showing that. Mm. That's crazy.
Well, that's more breaking news from the Useful Idiots a decision desk because no one else probably knows that.
Yeah.
So
she unsuspended. Yeah, she's running again.
Marianne is unsuspended.
I think
okay.
because, I mean, I don't have any inside info, but I assume it was because she actually beat Dean Phillips. And to beat Dean Phillips when Dean Phillips had all this, as we know, media coverage. We know that because we kept saying, what's this guy's name? We've never heard of him. And she didn't get on any of these shows. That it was a kind of impressive feat.
That is pretty embarrassing for Dean Phillips, who has been on these networks every single week, proving once again that nobody watches cable news.
Yeah.
Make this a protest vote against Biden's handling of Israel and Hamas, but take this with a grain of salt, too. You see those 100,000 votes uncommitted on the Michigan ballot every 4 years in these primaries. Even Barack Obama, 2012, unopposed, running for re-election, uncommitted, got over 10% of the vote against him. So in terms of the actual number of voters who are out there protesting Biden on the Israel-Hamas issue, who might stay home, might not vote for him in November, you're probably talking about a very, very small number. Of course, very, very close election, a very small number in that situation could matter here. So take a look.
Well, we'll see, Steve Carnacki. We'll see. I mean, we'll see if those words turn to be true, because what if indeed it is a small margin of victory and those uncommitted make the difference?
Then they'll blame us.
Absolutely.
Instead of Biden for not calling for ceasefire.
Yes, absolutely. All right. Well, let's get to Nikki Haley.
We do that, Aaron, I just want to give people some information in case people are interested in voting and sending that message to Biden. Okay. So if you live in the following states and are registered Democratic, or if they allow independents to vote in the Democratic primary, ask for a Democratic ballot. And here's where you can vote uncommitted. Okay. Minnesota and Tennessee, you can vote uncommitted. In North Carolina and Massachusetts, you can vote no preference. In Colorado, you can vote non-committed. There you go. And you can share that with your friends.
Yes. That's coming up. That's on Tuesday. That's on Tuesday, right? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
So another chance to show Biden that he's full of it.
Well, let's get to Nikki Haley. Excuse me. On Meet the Press.
Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham has taken up Donald Trump's position that he wants to support more aid to Ukraine only if it's in the form of a loan. Is that something you would support?
I think we need to give them the equipment and ammunition they need to win.
Is a loan appropriate?
I mean, you can do a loan if you want, but if that's like taking away the situation, what you should be looking at is Putin has been very clear. Once he takes Ukraine, he's not going to stop. Poland and the Baltics are next. Look at what's happening with.
Can we get one person on corporate TV to like fact check this claim from Nikki Haley, which she says every single week
Of course.
She says constantly that Putin has said he's going to invade Poland and the Baltics next. He's never said that. He's in fact said the exact opposite. He said, well, we'll invade someone if they attack us. That's what he said. But no one's going to, like, Poland is not going to attack Russia. Neither are the Baltic states. So, like, nobody can fact check her on that. She says it every single week, like, on every single show. That's like her boilerplate line. But nobody can say, actually, no, he hasn't said that.
Do you think really they strange. Just don't know? Like, they're total ignoramuses, or they know and they know that they can't say anything because they'll be called Putinists?
That's like the perennial question with all these people. Like,
right.
Are they dumb or are they just corrupt? Who right. knows?
Exactly, yeah.
Who knows? You never know.
Moldova now. Those are NATO countries, not Moldova, but the others. Those are NATO countries. That puts America at war. This is about preventing war. If we don't work with our allies to give them the equipment and ammunition to win, if Ukraine falls, Russia will go further, and that puts...
By the way, Nikki Haley coming out as the anti-war candidate. This is about war prevention. This is about fighting war to not have to fight war, I guess.
Yeah. You know, I've told this story before. This reminds me of when I was in elementary school, and there was a rumor in the schoolyard that some kids were throwing rocks, which I'm not even sure if the rumor was true or not. So me and my friends, we formed a group called the Rock Stoppers, right? But what we ended up doing is we started throwing rocks ourselves. But we build it as defensive. Like, are we throwing the rocks to prevent others from throwing the rocks? Even though the initial claim that people were throwing rocks was maybe not even true.
Right.
So Nikki Haley's doing her own version of the Rock Stoppers here. God,
Nikki Haley and the Rock Stoppers sounds like a good band.
In this case, though, her version of the Rock Stoppers entails funneling tens of billions of dollars right. of advanced weaponry into a country at war with Russia, which, by the way, we're helping directly. Like we're directly involved in, like, it just, there was just some leaked audio from some German military officials, four of them. And like Russia intercepted it and released it. And on the audio, they say they're talking about how they can deliver Taurus missiles to Ukraine and basically train Ukrainians to use the missiles so that Germans don't have to use it directly. But they're talking about what targets they want them to hit, including the Kerch Bridge, which connects Crimea to Russia. And they say that there are Western military operatives, including from the U.S., who are inside Ukraine, who are directly involved in targeting Russian sites. So, like, that's what's going on here. And that's what Nikki Haley wants to increase.
Wow. Aaron, I'm just glad that you had time during your active acting camp career as a child. Because, as people may know, Aaron was in War Games. Commercials.
Yes. Well, it's important to have varied interests. And I was stopping rocks and I was acting, you know, following my dream. Yeah. Yeah.
It's America at war. So this isn't about a loan. Give them the equipment and ammunition they need to win. And let's put this to bed. Biden was too slow in the process. And now Republicans are trying to play footsie with it. This is not something to play footsie with. This is about protecting Americans.
Yeah. You know, we've gone over this a million times. Russia has continued to take more territory the longer this war has gone on. Like, weeks into the war, there was a deal that could have seen Ukraine keep all of its territory. All they had to do was basically declare neutrality and accept protections for ethnic Russians inside Ukraine, including letting them speak their language, which they refused to do. So all this is just crazy talk, and it's just doubling down on an absolute disaster. But that's old news if you watch this show.
And we hope you do. And look at this very generous super chat from ADEK.
Please talk about the CIA's revelation about their bases and activities for a decade in Ukraine. Is this to pre-justify Russiagate intelligence to come, or an intelligence coup on Putin for the Russian people? This was a lot of info to spill. What justifies it for them? ADEK, thank you for that. What he's referring to here, or what they're referring to here, is this New York Times article that came out last week. We talked about it a bit with Chaz Freeman in the interview that came out on Friday, which basically disclosed that the CIA has been operating 12 bases along the Russian border inside Ukraine, which they've built over the last 8 years, ever since the U.S. backed a coup in Ukraine. And you look at that, you say, geez, the CIA has built 12 bases along the Russian border. Is that possibly what's called a provocation? Because you know how we always hear that the Russian invasion was unprovoked?
Right.
Is maybe building a you know, CIA bases along Russia's borders. That may be a provocation. There's other stuff in there too. We're not going to have time to go through all of it now, but the article was interesting, and I wonder what the motives were. One, I think, was to try to pressure Republicans in Congress to approve the $61 billion in military funding that they're holding up, because it's the way of saying, look, we're in there. We got 12 bases. Don't cut us off now. Like, we're in deep. But there are other motivations too, but we'll get to that some other time.
All righty. What do we got next? Where are we?
Well, so now we're going to turn to Gaza.
Yeah,
and last week saw a massacre of people lined up to get flour for themselves and their families because people are starving as a direct result of the U.S.-Israeli policy of blocking aid to Gaza and using starvation as a weapon. So before we hear people talk about all this, and by the way, and then there was another massacre of people waiting to get aid a few days after that too. So this is, I think it's fair to say this is a deliberate policy by Israel to starve people and then bomb them as they try to get the meager amounts of aid.
Absolutely disgusting.
And then in response to the outcry, what did Biden do? He announced an airdrop of food supplies, some of which is reportedly expired. People are getting these food packages and they're seeing that their expiration date has already passed. But of course, the amount of aid in this airdrop was like enough for one truck to go into Gaza, right, which is being blocked by Israel. So this aid delivery was just a stunt, but let's turn to a report from ABC News talking about all this.
First, ABC's Tom Sufi Burridge reports from Israel on the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza.
For the first time, the U.S. airdropping food aid into Gaza, pallets containing 38,000 ready-to-eat meals to try and alleviate the increasingly dire situation for nearly 2 million people on the ground. Half a million Gazans on the brink of famine, says the UN, with many children now suffering from acute malnutrition and some starving to death. President Biden saying he was compelled to act.
Innocent lives are on the line and children's lives are on the line.
The president announcing the airdrops just 24 hours after a deadly crush of people in northern Gaza amid Israeli military gunfire. This IDF drone video showing thousands of people surging around a convoy of aid trucks. More than 100 were killed, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. Israel saying its troops fired warning shots and only opened fire on a crowd when they got too close to one of their tanks, adding dozens of people were crushed to death in the chaos. Survivors recounting the horror. I went to get a sack of flour for my parents, Abdullah Juha says, and they shot at us. This scene yesterday showing how hungry people in Gaza are.
This is one of the main crossing points for those aid trucks from Egypt over there to Israel here and then on to Gaza.
Everyone, all right, everyone. Now we're going to get a window into the compassion and humanity that we're seeing from Israeli society as their government is mass murdering people inside a concentration camp. We're going to see how Israelis are turning out to respond to what their government is doing.
And remember, Israelis are the ones who value life.
Oh, yeah.
And Palestinians are the ones who don't value life and are value death only. Yeah.
Yes. Let's take a look.
But as you can see, this route is completely blocked off by these protesters. They say they're doing it to prevent any of that aid getting into the hands of Hamas.
Great people. What great people. Yeah, yeah.
You want to definitely kill all civilians just to make sure it doesn't get in the hands of Hamas. That's enlightened. That's liberal. That's the only democracy in the Middle East.
Yeah. Now, in fairness to Israel, there are some people who are protesting all this, but their numbers are minuscule. And actually, if you compare the number of people who have been protesting in Tel Aviv, you know, against Israel's massacre in Gaza, to the number of people who are there at the Gaza crossing blockading aid and setting up bouncy castles to have a good time as they're doing it, I would strongly bet that the number of people trying to block aid is a lot more people than those protesting that blockade, which is just tells you where Israel's at right now.
Israel facing mounting international pressure to address a looming catastrophe on the ground.
People in Gaza right now are starving to death, and you're not letting enough aid trucks reach those people in need.
First of all, people are not starving to death in Gaza
right now. Well, the UN says they are.
I beg to differ, but at any rate,
children at least.
But at any rate, Israel is enabling thousands of trucks to get into Gaza. Thousands, maybe tens of thousands of humanitarian trucks.
Good job by that journalist there, reminding this Israeli spokesperson that he's lying through his teeth. That yes, people are starving in Gaza, and being to starved. Deny that is just, I mean, it's par for the course. Also, note, and we've noted this before, this is yet another Israeli spokesperson who comes from, you know, some other country. He's like a settler from somewhere else. He's not even born in Israel. He's I don't know, European or American. I don't know what he is. But, you know, all these guys, they're not even, like, they come in from another country and then they are mouthpieces for a government trying to exterminate the indigenous population. It's such a strange display.
They come in from another country and they're given rights and in a country that's taking that takes away rights of others who were born there.
Okay, well, that's enough of this one. But kudos to that reporter, whoever he is, for actually challenging the Israeli spokesperson as the guy lies through his teeth. Let's turn to Ro Khanna, who took a long time for Ro to call for a ceasefire, but he finally did.
Welcome.
And now he's emerged kind of as a critic of Biden on this, but while still supporting Biden. So he spoke to Face the Nation.
Polling, we see nearly twice as many Democrats rate Biden's presidency fair or poor compared with Republicans who say the same about Trump. The president is having a problem with his base.
And that's why I think he needs to do something bold.
This is a problem.
This is a problem. But if he
Aaron, I have to ask you something. Is that a Caesar?
From who? Ro Khanna?
Yeah, Ro Khanna.
I don't think so. No.
Okay.
No,
I thought I got excited. I thought it was maybe Caesar. All right.
Yeah, no. This is our Caesar cam.
Yeah, Caesar cam. Yeah.
Yeah, the Caesar cam. I mean, from where I sit, for what it's worth.
How would you define a Caesar? Not to put you on the spot. You may not have your Caesar definition ready. So we can return to that.
You know, I just thought the Caesar is kind of, you know, it's associated with Mark Zuckerberg. It's pushed down.
Right. Top, too high up. Yeah, you're right.
I've been accused of having a Caesar before, which I've never accepted. Yeah, I've never accepted that.
Oh, but that actually, thank you. You should really recuse yourself from Caesar judgment then.
Yeah, well, you brought me in. You tagged me in. You know,
I did, but I didn't know that background. Yeah, that's actually, my bad. Okay.
Yeah.
Can turn it around, not just by calling for a ceasefire. If he becomes the first American president to convene Gulf allies, to convene Israel, to convene municipal leaders in Palestine and civic society and said, I'm going to get this done. I'm going to recognize a Palestinian state. I'm going to have a two-state solution. And I'm going to recognize that the security of Israel matters, but the end of occupation matters. He can become a hero. Look, the president has had an amazing public service career. My plea to him, forget electoral politics. Do this for people in the Middle East. It'll be a capstone to his legacy. I hope he'll meet with some of the progressive members of Congress to make that case to him.
Preview. He will not do any of that. And I don't even think he'll even meet with the progressive members of Congress because he only meets with you when he needs you and needs you for something. So, for example, you all voted for his dumb proxy war in Ukraine. And but now he doesn't need you for that anymore because he needs Republicans. So I don't see him doing that. And
if you're a fascist, he'll meet with you and kiss you on the head as he did with Maloney.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. That is true. Yes. Yeah. When she won, everyone was like, she's a fash. You know, this is the new right. And then all of a sudden she pledged that she was totally down with Biden on Ukraine. And then everyone's like, oh, great. Right. She got a fash pass.
She got that a fash pass.
Got.
Yeah.
She got a fash pass from
she
Biden.
She got azoved.
Yeah.
She got rehabilitated. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, there was a report recently in the Washington Post that Biden's aides are trying to basically strategize to bring him into contact with people as much as possible so that he can avoid protesters against the war.
Right. As little
the
as
massacre
possible.
In Gaza.
Not much as possible.
Yeah. Like, they want to avoid people as much as possible. So, so that's his new strategy. So I'm sure that will extend to progressive members of Congress who are opposed to him on the genocide as well. But also, it's just funny that, like, Ro Khanna says, it'd be something bold to demand a ceasefire. Like, is it bold to stop a genocide? Is that like a bold move? Is that really so daring? I mean, shouldn't we just be doing that for the sake of it?
Do something really bold and call for the following of international law.
All right. Well, here's more Ro.
You support the decision to airdrop in aid to Gaza. But this is only happening because the an ally of the United States, the largest recipient of U.S. military aid in the world, was not allowing in the aid. And now that it is coming across the border, the distribution is a massive, logistically complicated and unsafe operation. Should there...
It's not just complicated. It's Israel's using the delivery to kill people.
Right. It's deadly. It's lethal.
It's lethal. It's sadistic because they're waiting for people to gather for desperate aid that they need, and they're killing them. So it's not, you know, this framing from the media we got, like, oh, like these aid deliveries are chaotic. You know, all these headlines downplaying what Israel did. This is a part of that. No, it's like there was a massacre which Israel perpetrated against starving people.
Right. I mean, they're like, it's just so disgusting. It's a similar thing to what they're doing in Rafah. They're like gathering them all into one place and then attacking them. And how sick is it that they're gathering them all into one place so that they don't starve and you can get killed trying to not starve? And again, this is not natural starvation from lack of resources, like a bad crop or something year. This is man-made starvation. This is not letting in trucks. The food is there. It's just absolutely disgusting. Absolutely disgusting. And anyone who can see this and still defend what Israel is doing, you need to go to therapy. This is
because,
you know, sometimes we bring you pop culture talk. We also do mental health programming here. Yeah.
Consequences for standing in the way of U.S. humanitarian aid.
Yes, Margaret, there should. I mean, we should make it clear that we're not going to continue to transfer weapons, as I asked Secretary Austin at the hearing. But Margaret, look,
he didn't answer you.
He did not. But even you could tell from his testimony that he was concerned that we were continuing to transfer aid. Look, we can't transfer weapons. We can't.
You know, during Austin's testimony, it was amazing. This should have been headline news. He said, you know, Rokana asked him, how many women and children has Israel killed since October 7th? Lloyd Austin said over 25,000. So that's the Pentagon's figure there. Over 25,000 women and children have been killed with U.S. weapons since October 7th. That should have been front page news because the official toll is about 30,000. And we're told that that includes thousands of Hamas fighters. But Austin is saying just women and children alone is 25,000. So then you have to think about how many male civilians have been killed in that. And which means the actual toll is way over 25,000 and just alone. Women and children, 25,000. That's the official Pentagon tally, which was some news, and it should have been broadcast way more than it was. Everyone just kind of like, oh yeah, 25,000 women and children. Meh.
So gross.
Can't continue to transfer weapons while we're transferring aid. That policy doesn't make sense. Here's the thing. Look, the killing of over 100 Palestinians who are simply going to a food truck to get food, whether by a stampede or by shooting. We don't know all the facts. There should be an investigation.
No, we do know the facts. You know, one doctor at a hospital said that 80% of the victims he treated from that massacre had gunshot wounds. 80%. 80%. And there's plenty of other evidence for this. So it's not a mystery what happened.
Right.
But that has shocked the conscience of the world. And my plea to this president, who I support deeply, is, Mr. President, call for a permanent ceasefire. There's too much suffering and the release of all hostages. The policy of bear-hugging Netanyahu has not worked. Reach out to some of the former Obama officials like Ben Rhodes, Tommy Weiter, who have been saying we need a new direction of policy.
Call them Tommy Weiter. It's Tommy Vieter. But Tommy Weiter is a good nickname. Roe, so you say the policy of bear-hugging Netanyahu hasn't worked. How about the policy, your policy of bear-hugging Biden? Because even as you're calling on him to do something, you're still saying you support him. So how about you do what Rashida Tlaib has hinted at and supported in Michigan, saying that we're not going to give you our vote. You have to do something for it. In this case, doing something means stopping the genocide.
Right. Too much bear hugging all around.
Mm-hmm.
Put down your arms, guys. Put down your arms.
Policy. We need a permanent ceasefire, release of hostages. We need to call for a Palestinian state, a summit with our Gulf allies. The current policy is not working.
All right. Well, you know, that's the kind of thing where you go, is what Roe's saying better than nothing? I guess you could say it's better than nothing, but
yeah.
Is it bold? No, it's not. Is it minimally humane? No, it's not, because I think the policy should be from Democrats, we're not going to support Biden unless he demands a ceasefire. That, right. You have to use your leverage. Just as he's saying Biden has to use his leverage over Netanyahu, they have to use their leverage over Biden, or else it's meaningless.
Yeah. And he's not listening. People are saying this. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, why should he? You know, because they're saying they're going to support him anyway. So what does he care?
Shout out to everyone in the following up on the pun, by the way. They have the right to bear arms. Not bear arms. Yeah. Where are we at with likes? Where are we at with likes?
We just crossed 1K.
All right. That's good. I mean, we should have better, but.
But that, Katie, that was third. Your number back when we used to get about 2,500 live viewers. Now we get about 3,500. So.
Right. So it should be higher. We'll let it go for now because we have so much important stuff. But guys, please be better. Do better. All righty.
All right. Back to the action. Dick Durbin spoke to Dana Bash of CNN.
Senator, let's turn to what's happening in the Middle East. More than 100 Palestinian civilians were killed this week in Gaza when chaos erupted around food, aid trucks, and Israeli forces fired shots into the crowd. Your colleague, Senator Chris Murphy, told the Washington Post, quote, if this is what the war continues to look like, with people being shot and trampled as they desperately try to get their hands on one of a small number of food and flour trucks that's entering Gaza, it is not in the U.S. interest to continue to be part of that. Do you agree?
Yes, I do agree. And I have to tell you that the report from Gaza that 10 babies died of starvation in this last week, certified by medical authorities, I mean, is a gruesome fact. It should bring us all to our senses. This killing has to stop of the innocent people there. I certainly understand Israel's right to exist, its right to defend itself, and what the Hamas terrorists did on October 7th, the outrageous, atrocious conduct on their part. But it's reached a point where we have over 25,000 innocent people who have been killed in the process of rooting out Hamas, and it appears it's going from bad to worse. The medical situation on the ground there is horrible. Horrible, and there's just no excuse for it. So and this notion of airdrops and airlifts, I support that, but that is not going to solve the problem. I saw the first plane that discharged its cargo, and they said we can feed 38,000 people with what we just dropped. There are almost 2 million people in Gaza. It just shows the gravity of the situation.
So how?
Okay, and what has Senator Dick Durbin done? Well, you know, last month there was the Senate vote for the, quote, foreign aid bill, which is really just a military funding bill, $61 billion for the Ukraine proxy war, $14 billion for Israel. What did Dick Durbin do? He voted for it. So what is he actually doing to stop this war? He's voting for it when it counts.
Right. Nice talking points, though. We really appreciate that.
Yeah.
None other than Chris Murphy is next.
Yeah, another person who voted for the bill to give Israel billions of dollars to kill Palestinians. Senator Chris Murphy, what does he have to say?
Okay, I want to turn to what we saw in Michigan, where over 100,000 Democrats went to the polls and voted non-committed. Obviously, a protest vote to the president's handling of the situation in Gaza. How concerned, as a political matter, should Democrats be?
I don't think we should be concerned about this as a political matter, because this is such a critical issue relative to America's national security and the security of the Middle East. I would hope that the president doesn't make decisions about what to do in Gaza or the Middle East based upon how the votes line up. Listen, I think.
Don't listen to your constituents, Joe. I would really hope that the president not respond to what people want.
Yeah. He'll make decisions based on how the donors line up, not the voters.
I think it is time for the president to use all the leverage that he has to get a long-term ceasefire. I think if that ceasefire doesn't come, it's in Israel's interest for them to pause military activity to solve the humanitarian crisis. But to the extent the president is using additional leverage on Israel, he should do that for national security reasons, not for political reasons. These issues are too important to be dictated by the polls.
Is he not doing enough?
So what is he saying there? He's saying we need to use our leverage to get either a long-term ceasefire or a pause. So note that he's not using the term permanent ceasefire because he ultimately still endorses Israel's stated goal of destroying Hamas, which means destroying Gaza, because that's what Israel has been doing so far, destroying Gaza in the name of destroying Hamas.
Right.
So what is he really calling for? Nothing, really. He's at best, he's saying we should have a pause to the massacre so that we can get some more aid in. And meanwhile, Chris Murphy, again, he's another person who voted for the $14 billion measure for Israel to give Israel more weapons to kill people in Gaza.
Awful. But don't be influenced by voters, Biden.
No. Okay, let's turn to Debbie Dingell, who's
Aaron's favorite.
Well, this is interesting because, you know, she's a Congress member from Michigan. Her constituency, she represents a lot of Muslim Americans, Arab Americans. So she's in a tough spot because she has to, like, you know, represent both her constituents. Unlike Chris Murphy, she actually has to listen to her constituents. But also, she's a partisan card-carrying Democrat who serves the party and President Biden.
Right.
So she's in a tight spot. So let's see how she handles it on Meet the Press.
Wonderful to have you in person. Let's dive in and talk about what happened in Michigan this week. The uncommitted vote, as I just said, got about 13%. Two delegates are going to the convention this summer. How big of a warning sign do you see this as for President Biden?
So I'm going to answer this very differently, which is Michigan is a purple state, and I've been saying that for a long time. We are a state that frequently votes uncommitted. President Obama got a significant uncommitted vote in 2012. But it is one issue that needs to be paid attention to. I got a lot of people that are hurting in my district and in the district that I used to represent. The name of their campaign, or the one that I believe was effective, was called Listen to Michigan. They didn't think anybody was hearing the hurt that their families were facing. I have families that have lost 40 members of one family. They are the casework I'm doing for people that are starving, have no food. They want everybody to hear them. They're going to be an important group in November, but there's a lot of other groups that we have to make sure turn out. It's going to be a turnout election.
And there's no doubt about that. But this issue, Congresswoman, as you know, has really gained traction. In fact, 11 other states that are poised to vote have similar protest votes that are being mobilized. What is your message to those voters? And is the president doing enough to reach out to them?
I have had very direct conversations with the president, and I believe those conversations are private. But
I have had very direct conversations with the president, and I believe that those conversations are private. Wow. What a principled person you are to believe that. It's so embarrassing. She's just basically saying, I'm not going to tell you what happened, but presenting it as like some bold moral stance.
Well, it's the same thing that Biden administration officials do with Israel. They say, we're having very direct conversations,
right? Yes.
With Israel. We just can't tell you what we're saying, and we're not doing anything in right. public. But trust me, you got to believe me. Man, oh man, this is some frank talk behind the scenes. We're really giving it to them while we give them all the weapons to massacre people.
Right.
But trust me.
I'm sure she's also doing equally tough love with Biden, right? It's been effective.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know which is harsher, the words that Biden gets from her or the words that Biden gives to Israel. And obviously making a huge impact. Yeah.
I think you've seen a change that the White House has been reaching out more to the.
Sorry, there's been a change.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Change.
So what she means is they sent like a couple of, you know, poor aides like Samantha Power and John Finer to meet with some people in Michigan, where they gave him this like endless word salad about how like, we're so sorry. We love Palestinians. We haven't communicated that properly. But right. by the way, we're not going to change our policy.
Which supports killing them.
Yeah. So that's what she's talking about here.
Disgusting.
Oops, American Muslims community hearing their hurt. I am told that they are doing many things very directly. I pray that we're going to get a temporary ceasefire in a minute. I know that they've been working hard for that and that it leads to a permanent ceasefire. We need a ceasefire. We've lost 12,000 to 14,000 children. And what Hamas did was a terrorist act. And we want the hostages to come home. I think most Americans are horrified by what Hamas did. But social media is letting a lot of people see the horrific circumstances in Gaza.
Well,
I like that line. Social media is letting people see the horrific circumstances in Gaza. How about the corporate media? Are they letting them see that?
she doesn't even realize she's lodging she's engaging in critique of corporate media.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She's like, not you, Kristen Welker.
Yeah, she's like, I'm on state TV right now, so I know you guys don't actually cover the massacre properly, but social media, people are seeing it there. Man, oh man, it's bad.
It's just so awkward because she's trying to present to people that she's responsive, right? Like she's, mm-hmm. they're trying to cover their asses. But every time she points out how terrible it is in Gaza, all she's doing is actually indicting Joe Biden for not stopping it.
Yeah.
It's just like you can't really win when you're stumping for the guy who was letting this horrendous thing happen, but you also are trying to prove to people that you care.
Yes.
Yeah. Like if you care, then you should be actually forcefully making, demanding that Biden do the right thing.
Yes, exactly.
And just if you care about Israel, about Palestinians, you'd be forcing Israel to do the right thing.
Yeah. And using your leverage saying, we're not going to support someone who's complicit in genocide. It's not hard to say. It's not a tough position, I think. And again, what is she ultimately saying? We need a temporary ceasefire, which is the Biden administration line, which is, sure. But if you're endorsing Israeli conditions, which is that basically Hamas free all the captives and then the massacre is going to resume, it's not going to happen. So you're basically just saying this genocide needs to go on. That's ultimately what the Biden position is.
Yeah. And also we need to make sure the hostages aren't released, which is what's going to happen when the genocide goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, several weeks ago, there were protesters at several of President Biden's events. The First Lady had protesters just yesterday when she was talking. And we have reporting that the president's aides are actually trying to tailor some of his public events so that he interfaces less with these protesters, smaller events, no college campuses. Is that the right strategy, Congresswoman?
So I'm just going to say, I meet with everybody and was protested almost every day last week. I've called for a ceasefire. And there are a lot of very strong feelings. I know that the
strong feelings. How condescending and patronizing is that?
Mm-hmm.
The whole time she's talking about them like they're hurt children.
Yes. Yes.
They're fragile.
President will meet with this community. I think they're very raw right now. And I think let's get some pieces in place. But, I'm going to tell you something else. I don't hear Donald Trump talk about this at all. And I'm not exactly sure how he would be handling it. I have some pretty strong feelings about what would be happening there. Joe Biden is talking about it. Joe Biden is working hard to get that ceasefire.
Let me ask you about one of the...
That reminds me of that scene in The Office, the British version of The Office, when David Brent, he finds out that people are calling him Mr. Toad behind his back. And he goes like, Mr. Toad, what about him? And he points to one of his colleagues why aren't you calling him a mean name?
Right.
He's so offended. And that's what she's doing there. She's like, what about Trump?
Right.
Look, I'm sorry. Trump's not the president right now. Biden is.
Right. And he's supposed to be better than Trump.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yes. The butt Trump strategy, which always works so well.
Yes. All right. Let's turn to Senator Marco Rubio. He was on Fox News. And he made a very revealing admission about the Ukraine proxy war.
Here's what I do know. Here's what I do know. There is no way that the Russian Federation takes Ukraine, all of Ukraine, half of Ukraine. And that was Putin's goal from the beginning, was to carve it up into half, at least half the country, including Kyiv. That's not going to happen. On the other side of it, we have the reality.
Just a correction. I don't think that was Russia's goal. They sent a force of reportedly 160,000 troops. It's not enough to take half the country, including the capital. You need a lot more than that. I think their goal was to compel Ukraine to enter into negotiations that it was refusing prior to Russia's invasion. That's why you had negotiations start immediately after the war, culminating in the Istanbul talks, which the U.S. and U.K. ultimately sabotaged. So, we'll never know. Maybe that was Russia's goal. But, there's a former German general who was on the NATO military committee, a former member of NATO, who recently made the same point. That Russia's force in Ukraine was not enough at all to take half the country and to take Kyiv. Anyway, it's a counterfactual, but just something to clarify.
reality of it is that Ukraine is small compared to Russia in terms of size and its ability to bring scale, its ability to force conscript people. So neither kind. This is, I'm just being honest. And I've, and you know, in the past, I have tried not to talk about this publicly because I thought it undermined the leverage that Ukraine had. But now it's the reality. Neither side is going to be able to achieve victory as defined in the most idealistic terms.
He's like, I'm going to be honest, unlike I was before.
Exactly. So what he's saying is he knew all along that Ukraine could not achieve its stated goals of, you know, expelling Russian forces from all its territory. But he kept that from the public and he kept voting for this proxy war funding that he knew was futile. And now he's admitting it 2 years into Russia's invasion, right, and $100 billion later and tens of thousands of lives lost later.
And limbs and, you know.
So then the question becomes, if in fact there's going to be a negotiated settlement, who's going to have the leverage here? Is it going to be Putin or is it going to be Ukraine? And I want Ukraine to have the most amount of leverage possible when the time comes for those conversations to happen. They're not going to have leverage if Putin feels like he has the upper hand, that he has ways to gain and can force Ukraine into a situation where they become basically a satellite state, which is what he wants. He wants them to be like Belarus. He wants to keep territory, and then whatever's left over of Ukraine, he wants it to be a country that is forced to remain neutral and that in his orbit and sphere of influence. So I want Ukraine to have the most amount of leverage. And to do that, we have to help him. And I'm in favor of doing that, but we have to first take care of our country. So I believe that we should help Ukraine, but only after we help America through our border, in the same way as Democrats are saying, we won't help Israel unless you help Ukraine, and because they're holding Israel as leverage and hostage over Ukraine. So at the end,
so everyone's getting something here. Democrats, their brave position was like, or some of them, this is, I mean, some Democrats are on board with Israel funding them without conditions, but yeah. I guess he's saying that some Democrats are saying that we're not going to fund the Ukraine proxy war unless you help Israel, or they're saying we're not going to fund Israel unless you fund the Ukraine proxy war. That's what he's saying is the Democrats' position. And Republicans are saying, we're not going to fund Ukraine proxy war unless you help us further militarize the border. So everyone's getting something here, except for the people of the world who are getting screwed and more people will die. But yeah. So anyway, that's Marco Rubio. What a refreshing admission, though, that he was lying to the public.
Right.
He knew that Ukraine could not win, but he kept funding the war anyway. And now's the time to spit the truth out.
Crazy.
Okay, who do you want to do next? We have limited time, so
let's see, what are the options?
We can go to Congressmember Mike Turner. He recently got into trouble because he basically released a statement declaring that we're facing this huge national security threat and that Biden really should tell the public. And everyone started freaking out, like, oh my God, what is this? And then it turned out that it was this intelligence saying that Russia might want to build a nuclear weapon in space, which Russia denies. Who knows who's right? But Mike Turner certainly caused a lot of people to freak out unnecessarily, because apparently everybody agrees that whatever Russia's plans are, they're not doing this now. So Mike Turner was asked about this on CBS.
You raised public concern that got a lot of attention last month. That led to the White House declassifying intelligence that Russia's pursuing an anti-satellite capability. Serious concern. They said it would violate a treaty that bans weapons of mass destruction in space. Did your disclosure make a difference here? Do you think the administration is now dealing with it?
Right. And I did not do this alone. Let's be clear. My committee, 23-1, voted to disclose this information to Congress, because that's kind of our responsibility, is when we have something that's critical and there's oversight of the administration where we believe that they're not taking action, to notify Congress of this. And I do think they were sleepwalking into an international crisis. And I do think that as a result of the fact that we notified the rest of Congress, we did hold the administration accountable, and they're taking action. From what I understand, there was conflict with the administration as to what to do. I think Jake Sullivan here gets a tremendous amount of credit for moving on this and recognizing it's important. I can't confirm or deny exactly what this is, because they haven't declassified at all. But, you know, assuming if you take the news reports to be, you know, hypothetically accurate, you know, Jim Himes, my ranking member, has said this. You know, if this is true, this would be the equivalent to a Cuban Missile Crisis in space. Well, unfortunately, we don't have John F. Kennedy as president, and we need an administration that acts and that understands that this is a huge national security and international security threat.
Sounds great. A Cuban national, a Cuban missile crisis in space. What could go wrong?
I know. It sounds like a Mel Brooks movie.
Yeah. All the more reason for us to funnel another $61 billion into a proxy war with this nuclear armed power that we're fighting in Ukraine, rather than maybe engaging in the diplomacy that's been available even before Russia invaded, you know. But anyway, yeah, what could go wrong?
Oh my God, it's so depressing. Mm. Well, we have to show people our vice president, right?
Yes, we do.
Do we have time?
But before we can get to Chef Jose Andres, you know, he has a reputation among some of just basically, you know, going towards causes that are that serve U.S. government interests. So, for example, if he'll do something humanitarian, but only if the victims are being killed by our enemies, not being killed by us or our friends.
He also opposes raising the minimum wage for tip workers.
Oh, there we go. Okay. Yeah. Well, there he is. So he's known as a humanitarian, but, you know, not when it comes to treating, I guess, his own workers. But anyway, to his credit, he was helping out get food into Gaza. And he was on with ABC News talking about the Biden administration's airdrop of aid into Gaza.
Ask you about the airdrops, because there's been some in the humanitarian aid community have questioned them. Oxfam put out a statement just recently saying Oxfam does not support U.S. airdrops to Gaza, which would mostly serve, again, the Oxfam statement says, to relieve the guilty consciences of senior U.S. officials whose policies are contributing to the ongoing atrocities and the risk of famine in Gaza.
Yeah, this probably is written by somebody that doesn't have has a lot of time on his hands. Listen.
It's Oxfam, dude.
Yeah. Yeah.
We need to bring food into Gaza any way we can. If the airdrops are happening, Jordan began. The king of Jordan has been in some of those drops. They were doing it to bring food to their hospital. It's great that then they increased to 4 planes, 7 planes. So the countries join, more massive. Then U.S. follows suit. We should be bringing it by the sea, maritime. We should be putting boats in front of Gaza. I hope it's going to happen soon, where we can be bringing hundreds of thousands, if not millions of meals. Why are we doing the air? Why people are doing thinking about coming by the sea? Because the political situation is not allowing to bring safely enough trucks. Therefore, we need to be bold. I don't think we need to be criticizing that Jordan, America are doing airdrops. If anything, we should be applauding any initiative that brings food into Gaza.
Well, I actually... Well, you want to respond to that?
Well, just he's not identifying the culprit. He's saying we can't get the aid in because of the political situation.
Right.
Yeah. Like, what's the political? It's the government waging a starvation siege of Gaza, which is Israel with U.S. backing. That's the political situation. So there's no, you can't justify, you know, mincing words about that.
Right. I reached out to a friend of mine who's a human rights worker. And here's what he had to say. The airdrops are a fig leaf, a teeny amount, insignificant compared to overland deliveries, dangerous and mostly for PR. Actually, all right, I'll tell you who this is from. This is Craig McIver. Israel blocks the entry of aid, and the U.S. refuses to force them to allow the aid in. The airdrops allow the U.S. to push back against complicity charges domestically and internationally while changing nothing on the ground. And they also help get Israel off the hook. Parentheses, we are not committing genocide. We agreed airdrops with the U.S. End parentheses. While the people still starve and die of untreated disease, the airdrops are a lie. It is a distraction and a fig leaf allowed the U.S. and others to make it look like they were doing something. But all humanitarian agencies agree that it can only provide a drop in the bucket. Good PR, but no relief for 2.3 million Gazans. There is plenty of aid lined up in trucks. Israel is blocking its entry.
There you go. So I applaud the chef's efforts to get food into Gaza, but you can't whitewash the stunt that Biden's doing. Again, one airdrop is like one truck, or not even one full truck of aid, which are all being blocked by Israel with U.S. support. And those protesters those Israeli protesters who we saw earlier, that's the political situation, is you have sadism in Israel from the government and from people taking the time to block aid into a starving population.
Awful.
All right. Well, finally, we wanted to show this because this comment from Kamala Harris made some headlines. People interpreted this to mean that she's calling for a ceasefire. But you listen closely to what she's saying, and she's not. This is her, Kamala Harris, speaking on Sunday.
So cynical.
And given the immense scale of suffering in Gaza, there must be an immediate ceasefire.
Wait for it. Wait for it.
For at least the next 6 weeks.
So she's just reiterating what the Biden policy is. And again, who is responsible for all this? Who is it on to allow the 6 week pause to the massacre? You'll never guess.
Which is what is currently on the table. This will get the hostages out and get a significant amount of aid in. This would allow us to build something more enduring, to ensure Israel is secure, and to respect the right of the Palestinian people to dignity, freedom, and self-determination.
So, and she goes on to say that it's Hamas that needs to accept this. This is the deal on the table. Hamas needs to accept this. Okay. So the onus is on Hamas to basically bend to Israeli U.S. demands. And, you know, what's amazing there is, again, she's tacitly admitting that Israel and the U.S. are using aid as a weapon, because she says if Hamas accepts this, then a significant amount of aid will get in.
Right.
Well, if aid going in is conditional on hostages being released, that's an admission that you're using aid as a weapon. You're starving people on purpose. So she's actually admitting it there. And instead of picking up on that, people are misinterpreting her to mean that she's calling for a ceasefire. And I wonder if that pause was on purpose.
Yeah, so that they clipped it.
Yeah, so that they clipped just that, so that people can think as if they're calling for a ceasefire when they're actually not.
Absolutely disgusting, yeah. Well, last announcement I have, can I announce a show that I'm in?
Oh, yes.
So I'm going to be performing in this Laughs for Good. It's a stand-up show. It's a benefit for Gaza. It's already raised $7,000. And it is with Maysoon Zaid, Athir Yacoub, Michael Schertzer, Adam Mamawala. I'm a special appearance. I don't know what that means. And it's emceed by Kansu Karabiak. And it's in... it's in Yonkers, and it benefits Doctors Without Borders.
That's awesome. And that's on Friday, March 8th at 7:30.
At 7:30, yeah. And you can buy tickets. They're more expensive if you buy them for like in person. But if you can't do that, you can buy Zoom tickets.
Very cool. Very cool.
And we'll put the link in.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, so much for tuning in to another episode of Monday Morning. It's great to have you here with us. Our website, as always, is usefulidiotspodcast.com. You can go there to support the show and get bonus content. And we'll see you next time.
Yes, we'll see you next time. And Wilson, you'll put the Zoom in, right? The link in?
Yep, it'll be in the description shortly. Everyone can refresh and it'll be there.
Yeah, there are Zoom tickets and regular tickets, yeah. All right, bye, guys.